Usually, ancient social structures are treated a lot like hazardous material sites.
Right.
You have the yellow tape, the warning signs, the absolute rules of who goes where and who touches what.
Yes, exactly.
And there's this unspoken agreement to just play by those rules, basically just to keep the chaos out.
To survive, really.
Right. But if you look closely at the world of first century Galilee, specifically right around 28 to 30 AD, you see this historical landscape where someone is just casually tearing down all of that tape.
Oh, absolutely. Tearing it to shreds.
Yeah. So today, we are diving deep into a stack of historical notes and textual excerpts centered on Matthew chapter 8.
Mm-hmm.
And our mission here is to extract the explosive historical drama, the intense political tension, and the shocking cultural subversions hidden right there in the text.
What's fascinating here is the structural shift within the broader document itself.
Okay, how so?
Well, if you look at the preceding chapters, you have the Sermon on the Mount, right? That is this massive foundational block of theoretical theology and ethical teaching.
It's a very idea-focused.
Exactly. It's an ideological framework. But the moment we cross into chapter 8, the text transitions abruptly from words to actions.
Boom. Right into it.
Yeah. The theory hits the brutal, boots-on-the-ground reality of Capernaum.
And Capernaum is like the perfect crucible for this.
Oh, without a doubt.
Because we're talking about a bustling cosmopolitan trade hub on a major commercial route. You've got high ethnic friction, an entrenched military presence.
And a massive collision of Jewish and Hellenistic cultures.
Right. It's a border town in every sense of the word.
It really is.
Okay, well, let's unpack this, because that highly charged environment sets the stage for the core paradox of today's deep dive.
Mm-hmm.
As we examine these encounters, the people who fundamentally should be the most faithful, the religious insiders, the ones who know the texts, even the hand-picked followers, they constantly falter and cower in fear.
It's a running theme.
It really is.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, the absolute outcasts, the people pushed to the very margins, are the ones demonstrating this profound, unwavering trust.
Yeah, it is a complete ideological inversion of the expected social order.
Which is wild.
It is. And to understand the gravity of that inversion, we really have to examine the architectural theology of the era.
Okay, set the scene for us.
So first century Judean and Galilean society was built on strict degrees of holiness and ritual purity.
Right, the yellow tape.
Exactly. The entire social order was just these concentric circles of access, and those boundaries were vigorously enforced.
Which makes the very first action in this rapid-fire sequence so staggering.
Yeah, it really sets the tone.
A man with leprosy approaches and kneels. And the text is incredibly specific. He says, "Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean."
Right. Notice the phrasing there?
Yeah, he's not merely asking for a medical cure, is he?
Not at all. He is asking for a reversal of his ritual alienation.
He wants to be brought back inside the yellow tape.
Exactly. And Jesus reaches out and physically touches him.
Wow. Which is, I mean, physically touching him.
The physical touch is the pivot point of the entire narrative.
Okay, explain that. Because modern readers might just think, oh, he patted him on the shoulder.
Far from it. Under the protocols laid out in Leviticus 13 and 14, impurity wasn't just a fragile state. It was viewed as an active contagion.
Like radioactive.
Basically, yeah. You didn't just break a social norm by touching a leper. You contracted their untouchable status.
Oh, what?
You inherited their social debt.
But wait, if we look at the historical context of that exact moment, wouldn't the crowd witnessing this just assume Jesus was now ritually unclean too?
That is the logical assumption, yeah.
I mean, how do we know they interpreted it as him cleansing the leper rather than him just breaking the law and getting instantly contaminated?
Well, that is precisely the crux of the subversion here.
Okay.
In the normal order of ancient Near Eastern purity laws, the unclean always contaminates the clean.
Right. A drop of ink ruins the glass of water.
Exactly. But Jesus reverses the very mechanism of contagion.
Wait.
He isn't contaminated by the outcast. His purity actively cleanses the outcast.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, he introduces a concept of holiness that isn't a fragile defensive posture that needs to be protected, but rather an aggressive radiant force.
Like a white-hot forge.
That's a great analogy. The fire isn't tainted by the impure metal. It consumes the impurity.
Wow.
So by touching the man and saying, "I am willing, be clean," he is claiming absolute sovereign authority over the purity laws themselves.
That is heavy. But overcoming a biological quarantine is one thing. That was really just a warm-up for crossing a geopolitical landmine.
Oh, yeah. The stakes jump up immediately.
Because Jesus pivots directly from challenging Moses' purity laws to challenging Caesar's military authority.
Mm-hmm.
We move straight from a medical outcast to a deeply hated political enemy.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the geopolitical reality of the region was completely defined by a suffocating Roman domination.
Right. It was brutal.
Yeah. Pompey's conquest in 63 BC wasn't just like a historical footnote. It inflicted a generational trauma.
A deep scar on the psyche of the people.
Exactly. It fueled violent zealot undercurrents and drove these fervent messianic expectations that were fundamentally military in nature.
People wanted a warrior.
Right. The local populace was desperate for a political liberator who would crush Rome and restore their sovereignty.
And right into the middle of that boiling cauldron walks an agent of the occupation, a Roman centurion.
A commander of 100 men.
Yeah. When this centurion approaches, we don't just have a military occupier. We have a living, breathing agent of the Roman patron-client system.
Oh, yeah.
These officers were the visible enforcers of the cruel oppression and the crushing taxation that was actively starving the local population.
They were the absolute face of the enemy.
So if you're a local living under that system, watching this centurion confidently approach your would-be political liberator,
you're waiting for the explosion.
Exactly. You would expect a confrontation. You would fully expect Jesus to denounce him right there in the street as an agent of the occupation.
Oh, it would be the perfect PR moment for a messianic claimant to rally the zealots.
Exactly.
That would certainly be the expectation of the crowd. But the centurion completely subverts the patron-client dynamic.
How does he do that?
Well, he doesn't leverage his social dominance or his military backing. He seeks healing for his servant. But more importantly, he articulates an understanding of a divine chain of command.
Oh, right.
And this chain of command completely supersedes Rome's authority.
Because he says, just say the word.
Exactly. He essentially says, I understand how orders work. You don't even need to come to my house. Just issue the command and reality will obey.
It's a stunning recognition of authority. But the real shockwave is Jesus' reaction.
Yeah, it's wild.
He turns to the crowd and says, truly, I tell you, I have not found anyone in Israel with such great faith.
Right in front of everyone.
I mean, praising a Roman officer's faith above the faith of the covenant people, that isn't just a theological shift. To a first century zealot ear, that borders on treason.
Oh, absolutely. It is a massive dismantling of ethnocentric power structures.
It really is.
Up to this point, participation in the kingdom was deeply tethered to lineage, national identity, and strict adherence to the law.
You were born into it, basically.
Right. Jesus is signaling a highly controversial, paradigm-shifting reality.
Which is?
Belonging in this kingdom is entirely about recognizing his ultimate authority and responding with faith, even if you are the political enemy of the state.
Oh.
He is radically redefining the boundaries of who gets to be an insider.
Which forces us to look at the glaring, uncomfortable irony regarding the actual insiders in our source material.
Yeah, we have to talk about them.
Because if the societal outcast and the political enemy are the ones demonstrating this incredible clarity and trust, we have to turn the lens on Jesus' own inner circle.
Yes, because as the text progresses, Jesus begins to explicitly challenge the half-hearted commitments of the eager scribes and would-be followers who are just drawn to the spectacle of his power.
The crowds who just want a show.
Exactly. He warns them that the cost of discipleship is total reliance.
Mm-hmm.
And he tests that reliance almost immediately by leading them into an environment they cannot control.
Right. They get into a boat to cross the Sea of Galilee.
Yep.
And when the squall hits, here's where it gets really interesting. We're not just looking at bad weather.
Not at all.
We're looking at a psychological collapse of the very people who just watched these biological and political boundaries get shattered.
Total panic.
You've experienced fishermen panicking that they are all going to die while Jesus is asleep.
This exposes a critical, often overlooked gap between proximity and trust.
Oh, I like that phrasing.
Being close to the power, even witnessing the power firsthand, didn't automatically translate to resting in that power when their own survival was on the line.
That is so true.
But there is a deeper cosmological layer here, too.
Okay, what is it?
In ancient Near Eastern thought, the sea wasn't just a body of water.
Right.
It represented primordial chaos, the abyss, the untamable forces of destruction.
So when Jesus effortlessly calms the storm, and the winds and waves completely die down, it's not just a neat meteorological trick.
You're from it.
It's a direct claim to divine authority over the abyss itself.
Exactly.
That's why the text says the disciples were amazed and asked, "What kind of man is this? Even the winds and the waves obey him."
Exactly. Structurally, this event establishes his absolute authority over cosmic and natural forces.
Mm-hmm.
But narratively, it serves as a stark, unforgiving mirror.
Oh, definitely.
It explicitly exposes the faltering, fragile faith of those closest to him. Think about it. The leper intuitively knew Jesus' touch could heal.
Right.
The centurion intellectually knew Jesus' word was absolute law.
Yeah.
But the hand-picked disciples, in the middle of a chaotic storm, completely forgot who they were sitting next to.
It is such a striking psychological contrast.
It really is.
And having just established this massive authority over the chaotic forces of nature, Jesus steps off the boat and walks directly into a cultural and economic storm.
Yeah, he doesn't take a break.
He brings this disruptive power straight into foreign territory.
So they arrive in the region of the Gadarenes, which is part of the Hellenistic Decapolis.
Okay.
Geographically and culturally, this is a severe shift. This is predominantly Gentile pagan territory.
Very different from Capernaum.
Oh, entirely.
Yeah.
And the text uses the presence of large herds of pigs to clearly demarcate this as the absolute epitome of foreign unclean soil for a Jewish rabbi.
Right. Now, we don't need to recount the literal play-by-play of the exorcism, because the key insight here isn't really the mechanics of sending demons into a herd of swine.
No, it's what happens next.
Exactly. The crucial takeaway is the aftermath, because when the swine perish in the water, the local Decapolis economy takes a massive, devastating hit.
A huge hit.
The pork industry was incredibly lucrative, supplying Roman garrisons and Hellenistic elites. Jesus just destroyed a massive capital investment.
Which forces us to analyze the socioeconomic calculus of the Gadarenes.
Right. Let's look at their reaction.
This raises an important question. You have two men who were violent, isolated outcasts, right?
Completely uncontrollable.
And now they are completely restored and delivered from horrific demonic oppression.
Sitting there in their right minds.
Exactly. You would expect a community to celebrate the miraculous restoration of human life.
You would hope so.
But they don't.
No, they do not.
The ensuing reaction from the locals isn't about awe at the supernatural. It is sheer panic-driven economic self-preservation.
They look at the restored men, then they look at their ruined ledger, and they make a choice.
A very clear choice.
They prioritize their economic stability over human deliverance.
Yeah.
They actually beg Jesus to leave their region. Aww. Right? They essentially view him as an economic terrorist who is far too dangerous to keep around.
It is a sobering reflection on human nature's tolerance for disruption.
Wow, yeah.
The people of the Gadarenes decided they preferred the familiar, manageable chaos of demonic oppression over the costly, uncontrollable deliverance that Jesus brought.
This is so dark, but so true.
Transformative power is entirely welcome until it threatens the bottom line.
Man. Which brings us to the ultimate question as you're listening to this deep dive.
Yeah.
What is the actual mechanism of rejection happening here?
Right.
We started by talking about the yellow tape of ancient societal boundaries. But the deeper we get into these historical notes, the more it seems like the most dangerous boundaries aren't the ones enforced by Roman steel or Levitical law.
I think that leads us to a crucial provocative thought, one that builds on the entirety of this historical text.
I'm ready. Let's hear it.
Think about this. If Jesus' authority completely overrides biological disease, imperial Rome, cosmic forces, and ancient laws,
right.
What does that mean for the modern self-imposed boundaries we build today?
Oh, no.
If the religious elite lacked faith, if the inner circle cowered in fear, and if the locals chose their financial security over a profound miracle,
yeah.
Then perhaps true uncleanness has nothing to do with physical leprosy or foreign soil.
Right.
Perhaps the true impurity this text points to is a human heart that stubbornly values its own economic stability, political comfort, and illusion of control over yielding to ultimate authority.
That is a heavy thought.
Are we secretly relying on our own modern yellow tape to avoid the absolute surrender this text demands?
Wow. That completely reframes the entire narrative.
Yeah, it really does.
Maybe we are the ones desperately trying to contain the very things that might actually set us free, simply because we are terrified of the disruption it would cause to our carefully curated lives.
It's definitely something to think about.
It absolutely is. Well, we want to hear from you. Drop a comment below with your thoughts on today's historical drama. Like, which of these subversive moments surprised you the most?
Yeah, I'd love to read those.
If you enjoy diving deep into this history with us, make sure to like and subscribe so you never miss out.
Definitely.
And don't forget to check the description below for exclusive links to more resources.
Lots of good stuff down there.
Get ready, because our next deep dive into these sources will be even more intense. See you next time.